thank you very much for a very nice, inspiring talk. Does anybody have any questions?
Have you thought about using this for computer graphics to go from the font presentation to pixels?
Yes. Yeah, it's much better if you repeat the question. The guy who's close to the mic. Yes, we have thought about that. That's a harder thing to do, but yes, I'm very interested in that. I'm not going to say any more about that now, but it's a very good idea. There is a system that does something like that by Ruslan Salakudinov and Kiros at Toronto that you can actually take the caption, you can change a word in the caption. If it says it's an image of a red car, you can say, okay, give me an image of a blue car, and it'll give you an image of a blue car. That's a very nice system, but I'm not going to talk any more about that.
Any other questions? Yeah. Alex?
From the point of view of understanding natural language, what if you hooked up an understander of English and a generator of English, presumably you ought to be able to obtain lots of paraphrases, which would be the goal of, you know, a sign of good English understanding. I have a suspicion that you couldn't get from a sentence to its passive form because the system is so word-oriented. What's your opinion about ways to proceed?
My opinion is that you're completely wrong. What you can do is you can look at the thought vector you get from an English sentence, and you can plot that in a 2D map in such a way that sentences that have very similar thought vectors are very close to one another. And we've done that experiment, or the people doing this work did that experiment. And if you take, for example, in the garden, John gave Mary the book, and in the garden, Mary gave John the book, and John gave Mary the book in the garden, and the book was given to John by Mary in the garden, what you discover is the active and passive forms that convey the same meaning, independently of whether you put the negation at the beginning or the end, it's the things that have the same meaning that are close to one another in the thought vector. So it understands very well about active and passive. Another way of showing that it really does understand what's going on in the English sentence, notice, for example, that it turns the whole English sentence into one thought vector and then produces French sentence. So it's not doing anything like word-for-word translation. It's very good at doing paraphrases. In fact, its weakness is, if it doesn't really understand the English sentence, it just confabulates. It wouldn't be very good to have this translating between Obama and Putin, for example. Because if it doesn't understand what one of them says, it makes up something plausible. Another way we've used this is you can take an English sentence, you can use the Berkeley parser, which is very good, to produce a constituency parser of that sentence. You can then flatten the constituency parse, so it's just a string of symbols, and now you can treat that as a machine translation problem. So you can give it an English sentence, and it has to produce as output, after having heard the whole English sentence, which might be like 70 words long, it has to produce as output the constituency parser of that sentence. And it works just fine. In fact, it works slightly better than the Berkeley parser that it was trained with. The Berkeley parser was used to parse 7 million sentences. The neural net was trained on those 7 million sentences. And it's just the same net as the translation net. It's got no prior knowledge about what it's doing, that this is a funny language it's translating into. And it produces parsers slightly better than the Berkeley parser that was used to train. So it really does understand what's going on in sentences. I mean, that's the best evidence you can get, right? That's the evidence you get. That's the evidence that suggests that you understand what's going on in sentences, that you can produce the parts.
So how similar or different would the thought behind a sentence be versus the thought behind an image from a neural net?
Okay. So there you have to embed them both into the same space. And people are working on that. The work by Ruslan Salakudinov at Toronto and Kiros and other people suggests you can do that just fine. You can embed into a single space images and sentences, and then you can try messing with sentences to change images, and that's how they get different colored images of different colored cars. It's not fully generative yet. They don't fully generate the image. They just look around for an image that has a similar embedding, that has the appropriate embedding. But in the end, we'll be able to fully generate the images, I think. And that's a fine thing to do, and it's going to work.
So there has been a recent work by Jeff Kloon where they have shown that deep nets can be easily fooled. So no matter what trained network you give me, I can construct examples which will be wrong with very high confidence. So does that scare us?
Yes. Yep. What's going on there is, if this work, by the way, this isn't a property of deep neural networks. This property applies equally well to logistic regression. If I just do classification by logistic regression, if I look for adversarial changes, I can get similar behavior. It's nothing about deep neural networks being mysterious that causes this. It's about, if you choose to analyze an image in a particular way, and I adversarially make use of the way you're analyzing an image to try and make a deceptive image, I can do that very well. Animals are doing this with camouflage all the time. Conjurers are doing this all the time. So when we analyze images, there's this sequential process of deciding where to look. And normally that doesn't get us into trouble at all. In normal perception, our decisions about where to look are independent of what's in the world. But if you make what's in the world be a function of where we look, or be a function of where we're likely to look, then we get seriously wrong ideas of what's in the world, and that's called magic. What conjurers are doing is, they're knowing where you're going to look, and they're making all the action be in the place you're not looking. And because you think you're getting a fair random sample of what's going on in the world, you fail to see what's there. So people have the same problem if you do adversarial things with them. There's a famous Victorian conjurer who would get off the stage, walk into the audience, and from out of thin air, he would produce a live goat, which is a pretty good trick. And the way it works is, he had a big red flag, and he waved the red flag above his head when he walked off the stage, and everybody looked at the red flag. He had the goat under his coat, and as soon as he stopped waving the red flag, he produced the goat from under his coat, and people were amazed. Because they'd never actually looked at him. Their visual system thought they knew what was there. That blob was clearly this person who was waving the red flag. So people suffer from adversarial things too. If you know how a system works and you can modify an image, making use of your knowledge of how the system works, I think you can screw more or less any system.
So what are the limitations of the current state of the art in deep neural network?
I think you said, what are the limitations of deep learning?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So I think one limitation is, it's not good for systems where you're totally dominated by noise, and you need to be very, very careful about what structure is really there and what is just noise. So typically financial prediction, a lot of medical data, trying to predict outcomes, for example, is in that regime. And I don't think deep learning is going to be much good there. But whenever there's intricate structure, and a lot of it, but we don't quite know how to represent it, then deep learning is going to be very good. So let me give you a few other examples. If you have some particle tracks and you want to decide if they're evidence for a Higgs boson, deep learning is now the most sensitive way to detect a Higgs boson. If you want to classify galaxies, deep learning is very good for that. If you want to look at the bits of the DNA that are not doing the coding and figure out which bits of that non-coding DNA, the 98% that most people think is junk, which bits of that non-coding DNA are controlling the way in which genes are expressed, and particularly controlling it differently in different tissues, deep learning has proved to be very good for that. There's a paper in Science that came out just before Christmas that shows that they can now find mutations in non-coding DNA and correlate those with outcomes. So they can find mutations in non-coding DNA that cause autism, for example, or that are highly correlated with autism, much better than they previously could. And they do that by using deep learning. Deep learning is extremely good at, if I give you 9,000 properties of a molecule and say, will this molecule bind to a particular target? Deep learning is the best technique for doing that now. And in fact, Merck's drug prediction pipeline has now switched to using deep learning for doing that. So I think it's going to permeate all of science. Anything where you need to find complicated structure, well, ask yourself the following question. Who do you think is better at finding this weird structure, particularly if it's weird structure that we didn't evolve to be good at finding? A system that can optimize a billion parameters using a lot of computation, or a person? Well, for stuff we evolved to do, we are optimizing billions of parameters, I think, and so we're very good at that. But for stuff like predicting the activity of a molecule or finding a Higgs boson, I think deep learning is going to end up being much better than people.
You have to come. Speak it out.
Come closer.
We're having him come a little closer,
yeah,
sir.
Okay.
Yeah, my question is how useful are is unsupervised pre-training by RBMs for tasks like ImageNet classification, where there are thousands, many millions of labeled data?
Okay. So when you've got millions of labeled examples and you use convolutions, pre-training isn't nearly as necessary. If you take, but even with convolutional nets, if you have not much data, then pre-training helps a lot. So Jan LeCun's group has shown that a few years ago, for pedestrian detection, pre-training was a big help. They got the best results on pedestrian detection using pre-training, even though they had quite a lot of data. So it depends a bit on the problem. But the rule of thumb is, if you've got a whole lot of labeled data, like hundreds of millions of examples, you're not going to need pre-training. But you do need to initialize the weight scale to the appropriate scales.
We have to turn on the microphone, it's not on.
It's also the case that by using these rectified linear units, you make it much easier to train deep nets. With logistic units, if you don't initialize the weights very carefully, your gradients all vanish and you just don't get any progress.
Okay, two more questions.
Do you see the results of deep learning falling into some kind of a computer graphics uncanny valley where the predicted words are good enough but they don't ever reach a perfect prediction of the caption?
I'm not sure why you call it an uncanny valley. I mean, it's certainly the case that when you've got something that works well enough for what you care about, there's not much point making it any better. So for reading house numbers now, Google's system for reading house numbers is as good as or slightly better than people. And that's good enough, basically. So my guess is there's not a whole lot of pressure to make that system work much better. If that's what you mean, then sure, once you've got something that pretty much works, the pressure to make it better goes away. But for things like object recognition and speech recognition, we're nowhere near that point.
Yeah, Jeff, I have one question. How about extending your system's deep learning method for movement and extraction of three-dimensional information from video? Have you looked into that kind of problem?
Obviously, many people are looking at that. We're looking at that at Google, they're looking at that at many other places. It's kind of the new frontier. Static images, you can do a lot with static images, and when you have small computers, you're pretty much stuck with them. But video is much more interesting. And in fact, for dealing with all sorts of issues in vision, it's simpler with video than with static images. If you've got a static scene in a moving camera, the moving camera is giving you huge amounts of information in a fairly simple form about the 3D structure of the scene. You could learn about 3D by just looking at lots of static images, sort of philosophically, but you're much better off having a moving camera. And so the new frontier is dealing with video. And of course, Google would like to be able to take YouTube videos and figure out what's going on in them. You could do much better search. I mean, it'd be very nice if you could say, find me a YouTube video in which somebody slips on a banana skin and a whole bunch of people laugh at them. And you might be able to do that just using captures at present. But it would be nice if we could just understand all the videos. And so, I mean, that's just one application.
Yeah.
Obviously, the surveillance industry would like to understand all sorts of things about videos. I don't think Google's got much interest in that.
Yeah, one problem
Here is the new frontier.
One problem I'd be very curious to see how it works is, I've been working now 20 years on sign language recognition, Americans for deaf people. So how would a system like yours work there, especially because there's a lot of domain knowledge that needs to be input, or maybe not, you know, to recognize signs, because it's very complicated. So is anybody working in these areas? And associated with this question is, can you input domain knowledge, even though it's bottom-up or driven, data-driven, basically, the approach? Can you, if you knew something about the domain, could you introduce that into the system?
So let me say several things about that. Yana Khan's group recently has produced some very nice stuff that will get poses of human figures. So they're doing much better than previously at sort of turning a real image and putting in the stick figure for the person. And you could do the same for a hand. And deep networks are really good for that. Deep convolutional networks do a really good job of that. So kind of half the problem with sign language, you could do just statically, of trying to find the hand. Obviously, you'll do better if you do it on voxels instead of pixels, and you're going for the real motion. You then like to combine that with stuff that knows all sorts of things about sign language. You can put in lots of prior information by building yourself a graphics model and using the graphics model to generate synthetic images. The synthetic images don't have to be very like real images, but if they're a bit like real images, that helps a lot. And so you can now make a data set that's labeled examples that are real, plus synthetic examples that look moderately similar. And in fact, for the Kinect box, that's where they trained it. They put in lots of synthetic examples to supplement real data. And that will be the way to put in lots of examples of sign language. You make yourself a graphics model that can produce examples of people signing things in American Sign Language. And if you make a good graphics model, you can use it to create a lot of training data. So that's the really easy way to put in prior knowledge. You just use it to create extra training data. And then you don't have to decide how the neural network should be coding it.
Okay, that I can take offline, because I'd like to send you some papers to see the state of the art. Yeah, and then we can discuss. Maybe it could be interesting to see.
We have a question from a remote site, sir. Can deep learning be used to detect the 6D configuration of an object in a 3D scene?
Yes.
That was easy. Thank you.
Okay, so I think we've asked a lot of questions. Again, Professor Hindon, thanks very much for your time and talk. And if anybody else has any questions, you can always email him. Again, thanks very much.
And well, thank you very much for inviting me.